Thanks very much. Let me just say, I want to make a few general points about the financial regulatory agenda. I didn't actually know what Min Ju was going to talk about. As it turns out, he's talked about something actually I was going to talk about, so I can follow directly on from what he said. You're going to hear more about funding of dealer inventories than you ever probably wanted to in a second. So let me just first make a general point about regulatory change. So a number of the regulatory changes in financial markets have increased the price of financial intermediation and the provision of financial services generally. That's actually very much been the intent. The price of financial intermediation, the price of provision of financial services has gone up. That's the idea. That's not, I really hate this expression, but it's not an unintended consequence. It's actually the idea. So the price of intermediation was too low before the crisis. Now it's higher. It was too low in the sense that risks were underpriced. Sorry, this, can I think I'm getting feedback that way, possibly.
No, it's like you say, the price is higher.
That's right then, yeah. It was too low in the sense that risks were underpriced. These risks include, liquidity risk and counterparty risk. And so reforms such as Basel III, which is about, well, at least one aspect of it, is about liquidity risk. OTC reforms are about counterparty risk. They're very much aimed at ensuring these risks are more appropriately priced. And so as the financial institutions are adapting to these reforms, they're repricing many of the services they are providing to take fuller account of those risks. That repricing is actually only really occurring now, hasn't really occurred much up until now. And so end users of these services are only now starting to see the impact of these regulatory reforms in the form of higher prices. So as in many markets, when a price goes up, the quantity goes down. Again, this is expected and desired. It is not unintended. What is less clear is whether various regulations are having an impact on the market above and beyond the effect caused by a higher price. So the general aim, I would think, of the regulatory strategy is for the price to do most of the work, but in some cases, regulations with a quantitative element are in place, sometimes as a backstop. And so the example which I had decided to give turns out to be exactly the one that Min Ju was talking about, which is the effect of some of this regulation on dealer inventories of fixed income. So there are these dealers out there who intermediate as people want to buy or sell bonds. The question is, are they holding enough inventory to be able to do that, and is that causing market function? And that's very dysfunction, sorry. And that's very much what Min Ju was talking about. So liquidity regulation has caused some repricing in the market with somewhat lower inventories, particularly of less liquid securities as a result. So aspects of the regulation have increased the cost, and you would expect that to increase the price of providing the service. In the case of dealer inventories, you're going to see that in a wider bid-ask spread. And in turn, you would expect them to be lower turnover and probably lower inventories. In addition to the repricing because of liquidity regulation and the like, something like the leverage ratio sits there as a backstop, limiting the overall size of institutions' balance sheets. Whether it binds in practice depends on the structure of the whole balance sheet. Given the general tendency to fund these sort of inventories with repo, a leverage ratio can affect the size of the inventory a dealer is willing to hold to make a market. Whether that effect is binding or not, I think, is an open question, or whether all that we're seeing in terms of lower dealer inventory is purely the effect of the price effect I was talking about earlier. So the question is, has dealer inventory shrunk too much, causing excess market dysfunction? And as Min Ju said, a lot of people point to what happened between May and September as an example of that. But in answering that question, the benchmark for the appropriate pricing and the appropriate degree of liquidity in the market is not the pre-crisis state of affairs. That was an environment where those risks were very much underpriced, sorry, and consequently, this service was grossly oversupplied to the market. So that said, it's not, as best as I can tell, it appears that some significant share of the lower inventory in recent months and the resulting price movement was actually because of self-imposed constraints by financial institutions rather than those resulting from regulation. A number of the major dealers appear to have self-limited the size of inventories because of the resultant mark-to-market risk. So if you're sitting there holding a bunch of bonds as an inventory and the price is starting to fall through the floor, surprisingly, you don't actually want to be holding onto them. And so a lot of these institutions decided themselves to hold less inventory, which was very much a question reflecting the fact that the market was repricing a long way. And to come to a point Minju made, if you go back to the market pricing in May, before the Fed's continued communication policy, fixed income was basically, I think, grossly mispriced. It's much easier to explain where yields are now than it was to explain where they were before they sold off. And so some sell-off was always going to happen. Volatility in fixed income was incredibly low, and I would say also probably mispriced. And as I said, the sell-off was bound to happen. Not surprisingly, the dealers didn't want to be holding that inventory while that sell-off was going on. The constraint on their ability to make the markets was very much a self-imposed one. The regulatory constraint, I don't think, was particularly binding. So that example, I think, is reflected in a number of areas of the market. It is often, over the last few years, it has often been the self-imposed limit which has been the binding constraint. The regulatory imposed constraint serves more as a backstop for when the memories of the recent crisis fade, as they surely will in time. The regulatory constraint is designed to ensure that risk doesn't disappear from pricing when euphoria returns, which undoubtedly it will at some point. So as I said, if I look at the sell-off in the fixed income market between May and September, it's much easier to explain where the market got to than where it was when it started. And I think that's true across the board. The fact that volatility certainly picked up, but volatility before then I think was arguably way too low. Whether it may have overshot on the way through, and undoubtedly when markets sell off and move from one equilibrium to another, they tend to overshoot. That's bound to happen. But we were in an environment where both, I think, risk and volatility were very underpriced. And as we shift to an environment where they're more reasonably priced, not surprisingly, that generates a bit of disturbance along the way through. In terms of and just to pick up on finally on one other point that Minju was talking about in terms of the exit from unconventional monetary policy, I think an important point to remember is this is a good thing. When people are exiting from unconventional monetary policy because their economies are stronger and their economic outlooks are brighter, that I think is unambiguously a good thing and a hell of a lot better than the alternative. Is it disruptive along the way? Yes, it undoubtedly is going to be so, but the alternative is worse, which is the major economies in the world sit have stagnation indefinitely, and these sort of unconventional monetary policies continue indefinitely. That is a hell of a lot worse than the prospects associated with exit. But on that, I think the response, particularly in the emerging world and in this region, it's actually quite interesting to look at that and compare that with the Asian crisis. And there were a number of papers at the IMF conference that was mentioned earlier, which compared Asia now versus Asia in the 90s, Latin America now with Asia in the 90s. I mean, Latin America in the 90s wasn't anything really to be worth comparing to. And it's interesting to see that there are a number of countries, and to use the term which we seem to be popular these days, have basically graduated. There are a bunch of emerging economies who actually proved to be extremely resilient through that sell-off. There are some who it's not clear that they've necessarily got across the line, but there is a decent chunk which do seem to have got across the line. And I think one of the most obvious examples is actually Mexico. So the Mexican Central Bank actually lowered interest rates, has actually lowered them twice in a couple of last few months, in an environment where the Fed is potentially at least contemplating slowing the degree of easing in monetary policy, but in an environment where there's a reasonable amount of instability in the market. That's something the Mexicans could never have contemplated in the 90s, and it shows that their economy is a lot more resilient. It's also they were doing this in an environment when their exchange rate was going down rather than up, again, something they would have never have contemplated during the 90s. So there are clearly a number of emerging market economies which are much more resilient now. They have, as Minju was talking about, more buffers in place. They have basically, they've graduated to being a resilient economy. Those economies, I think, by and large, would welcome this exit from unconventional monetary policy and the fact that it reflects a stronger global economic environment. There are some countries which aren't not necessarily clear that they've got across the line, although some of them are probably fairly close and have some chance over the next few months potentially to increase their resiliency. But I think that's, as I said, the bottom line is, in the end, I think everyone should welcome, and we would certainly welcome, an exit from unconventional monetary policy and move back to a world where pricing is much more normal from the extremes that it's been over a number of the past few years. So let me finish there. Thanks.
While you're thinking, I might just perhaps ask Guy a question. We're touching a little bit on China, but we're talking about the internationalisation of the renminbi, or RMBI, to adopt the new vernacular. The Reserve Bank's been particularly interested in the study that SEFA's been undertaking around internationalisation of the currency. What's the Reserve Bank's particular focus and interest in this topic?
I mean, the primary... I mean, China obviously is our largest trading partner, but also the financial integration is also increasing considerably as well. But because so China's our largest trading partner, an increasing share of Chinese trade is being denominated in RMB. And so both on the economic front and also because of the increased financial linkages, we obviously have, we have a very intrinsic interest in Chinese financial liberalisation, in particular the increased use of the RMB. I mean, it very much gets to, the structure of our economy and also the changing structure of our financial markets here.
Jeff Garrett from the Australian School of Business. People are always worried about US-China relations, but if we look at the past 5 years, it looks like there's in fact been incredible coordination between American and Chinese policy. So in 2009, the US loosened fiscal policy and went on unprecedented monetary stimulus. In 2009, China did exactly the same thing, massive fiscal stimulus and incredible increase in lending from the government. So now we're in 2013, and I think what you've said is that there's coordination again between China and the US. That is that the US is going to tighten monetary policy, tighten fiscal policy at exactly the same time as China is going to resist the temptation to do more government investment. That tells me that you're saying that China and the US want a managed global slowdown, or to take some of the artificial juice out of the world economy over the next several years. How bad would it have to be for either China or the US to reverse that course of taking away the unprecedented measures that were introduced in 2009? And as Guy said, everyone knows we need to be taken out of the global economy, but in an environment where they're going to slow things down. What would change US or Chinese policy again in an environment in which I think you're saying a gradual letting out of air is what the global economy must endure?
For me or for
you?
For me. Oh, well, this is my lucky day, I have to say. Yeah. Thank you for the question. The first issue is, as Guy just mentioned, and the access to non-conventional monetary policy is a good thing, because stay in the low interest rates with ample liquidity generates a new risk, and the market volatilities and the risk appetites increase. We observe so many financial institutions taking more risk now, say before the May 22nd, and in their times. And make some institutions, insurance institutes, very difficult to make long-term investment. We observed a duration increase for the bonds market, which also create a structure issues as well. So low interest rates support the U.S. growth and certainly have some impact, but stay there on long core we're hurting. So I think access to non-conventional monetary policy is a good thing for U.S. It's good things for whole world, because when U.S. have a strong growth, access to that things, the circle of liquidity out, it's good. And it's good for U.S., it's good for world, because the whole world want to have a strong U.S. growth, because the U.S. remaining the biggest global economy. I think that's good that U.S., given the U.S. continues on the recovery path, although, I mean, still moderates, I think U.S. access to the non-conventional monetary policy is a good thing for everyone. And we see U.S. policy along this way. And on China side, when China facing the financial crisis, China did the biggest stimulus policy, as you mentioned, $4 trillion, actually it's more than $4 trillion, because plus adding banking loan and a few other things. So what happened is, could you create a big investment boom, and which also create a big debt boom.
the total social financing today and the debt ratios in China is roughly more than 200%. And particularly corporate debt ratio is way high. It's 130% of GDP. So China has the fastest debt growth rates in the whole world, and even in the emerging market, and today has probably highest the corporate debt ratios in the whole world, which is not sustainable, because you have a very high debt, and also and a lot of debt is supported by shadow banking sectors, and the capital formation ratio actually drops, and overcapacity become the main concerns in China. So China got to access to this expansionary monetary policy, slow down the credit growth, refuse to further stimulus. I think it's a very proper policy, which is good for China, it's good for the whole world.
So can I say, Jeff? Jeff. This is about a macro response because the economic outlook is better. Yep. It's not just doing it for the hell of it, of reducing the stimulus. So it's if the stimulus is calibrated right, then the global economy continues to grow at the appropriate place. So it's not. Grow as Minzhu mentioned earlier. The global economy is growing around about trend at the moment. I think the IMF forecast has a bit below this year, a bit above next year. This policy response is a reaction to the assumed outlook. So it's a good thing because if they're doing that, if they're exiting this policy, it's because the economy is actually stronger. That's, as I said, so it's an appropriately calibrated policy response, I would say, basically.
All it's saying is that in policy terms, both China and the US for the foreseeable future will be taking air out of the global economy because that's appropriate.
No, I'm not sure how they... I mean, I sort of had this idea that the global economy can grow at a particular pace. They're trying to ensure it continues. You know, they're doing their bit to ensure that it grows at roughly the right pace. I don't quite get the taking air. They're presumably trying to keep their growth. Actually, the U.S. growth, they're actually trying to keep their growth at least as strong as it is now. But the policy response will be calibrated, hopefully, roughly right to ensure that.
Questions for Guy Debelle. It's Nigel Freitas from Sky News Business. Ben Bernanke's come out this morning and said that he sees interest rates likely to remain at near zero levels for a considerable time to come. And some people are saying that now means tapering won't start until April or May. Given your comments just then about an exit from unconventional policy being a good thing that would be welcomed, how do you see that playing out here in our economy now?
All I'm saying is if their assessment is the outlook isn't strong enough to exit now, then I don't know any better than that. I'm just saying the day where this actually comes is a desirable thing because it actually means that the economy, their assessment is the US outlook is strong enough.
But that's going to mean our dollar's at a higher level. So what's that going to mean for us locally?
That our dollar's at a higher level.
Any other impacts at all, Guy, in terms of the RBA trying to balance that and bring that dollar down?
As we've said on a number of occasions, we would prefer it to be lower. One major thing which will do that will be the day when the US changes its monetary policy direction. The sooner that day comes, the better, but that's not in our hands, that's in their hands.